Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama today at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, where both Presidents Kennedy and Reagan made historic speeches calling for Russia and the U.S. to reduce their nuclear arsenals by one-third. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss the need for the U.S. to get rid of thousands of these Cold War relics, whether or not the Russians reciprocate. Then we will speak with Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the former Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper. We will discuss the nationwide protests in Brazil that began over police brutality in response to public protests over a rise in bus fares and have since spread to protests at soccer stadiums being built for next year's World Cup, where minority voices are making themselves heard about the need for investments in health, education, and social services. Then finally, we'll examine the issue of the domestic use of drones that came up in a Senate hearing today, where the outgoing head of the FBI said that drones have been used in America against Americans in a very minimal way with a very small footprint. Ryan Callow, a professor of law at the University of Washington, who was the former research director at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University, joins us to discuss today's hearings and his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the domestic use of drones. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Governmental Operations and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And the president made a speech today at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin where he called for a one-third reduction in the arsenals, the nuclear arsenals of both the U.S. and Russia. This is following a rather chilly meeting at the G8 meeting in Northern Ireland with Putin. Already, of course, the Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin has thrown some cold water on it. So what are the chances of the Russians... Yeah.
Well, the Russians are dragging their heels on this. There's no question about it. If they were more cooperative, we could more quickly reduce these excessive and obsolete nuclear weapons that we have. And the president clearly indicated his intention to negotiate further with the Russians. But he's not handcuffing his policy to the Russians. He's not going to let them dictate how many weapons we have or how much we spend on this Cold War arsenal. He clearly opened the door to making reductions regardless of what the Russians do. And the reason is clear. We have many, many more nuclear weapons than we need. It's hard to imagine using one nuclear weapon. We haven't for 68 years. 10 nuclear weapons in use would be a catastrophe beyond history, and 100 is completely unmanageable. We have 7,000. We spend about $50 to $60 billion a year to maintain this arsenal. That's what the president is getting at when he says it's time to modernize our national security policy for the 21st century.
My understanding is that within the nuclear arsenal itself, those that maintain it, for example, the people under the prairies in those silos, that there's been recent reports indicating a drop in morale. They've had to transfer a bunch of officers with their finger on the button because of poor morale. It would seem that guarding these obsolete weapons is difficult to maintain morale. One of the peculiar paradoxes of that report was that during the Cold War, the morale was high. In other words, these officers were prepared to press the button and obliterate mankind. Now they don't see the purpose of doing it. So isn't there a kind of nuclear rot, if you will, within our own nuclear services?
Ian, I think that's an excellent way of describing it. And, you know, whatever value these nuclear weapons may have had during the Cold War, whatever feelings officers may have had, that they were the front line, that they were the guardians of the ultimate guardians of the national security, that is long since gone. And now we take some of our best and brightest Air Force officers and we stick them in holes in the ground in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota where they wait and wait and wait to push buttons they know they are never going to push. So So they know they're in dead-end jobs, and morale is suffering because of that. We just had a couple of dozen officers disqualified at the ICBM base in North Dakota as unfit to do their jobs. So you have a major morale problem here, particularly with the ICBM fleet. And then you have cost issues. You know, we have 14 nuclear-armed submarines patrolling the ocean still, with over 800, almost 1,000 nuclear warheads ready to go. Well, we're cutting that fleet, but we now have plans to replace it with 12 new submarines, a whole new generation. Well, this is causing major budget problems for the Navy. If they build those nuclear-armed subs, they're going to be cutting their conventional fleet by 40%. So you're seeing big debate inside the Navy going, why are we doing this? Why are we still building the weapons? That's why you see a growing military consensus that we can safely reduce the number of weapons. The kinds of cuts the president announced today are just the beginning.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. So the president clearly choosing the Brandenburg Gate as the venue in the German capital, Berlin, is definitely echoing President Kennedy's famous speech, Ich bin ein Berliner, and of course Ronald Reagan's famous speech, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. What's your sense? I mean, the stuff that I've been getting over the website, you know, I get solicitations from right-wing groups that outnumber left-wing groups by about 1,000 to 1. But the left-wing groups that are sending me solicitations is talking about this is all smoke and mirrors, it's all nonsense, etc. Why is there that sense on the left that Obama's not serious?
Well, there's two things. One, he's definitely consciously wrapping himself in the legacy of John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. Both of them were nuclear abolitionists. Both of them wanted to get rid of these weapons. You remember Kennedy saying we have to abolish the weapons of war before they abolish us. And Reagan said his goal was to eliminate nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. So Obama understands that. He's carrying that forward. The concern is that Obama gave a great speech in Prague in 2009, laid out a very ambitious nuclear agenda, made 2 years of great progress, and then stopped. And his nuclear agenda has been dead in the water for the last two years. What you saw today was the president restarting this agenda, saying that, yes, this is still one of my top priorities. And I've talked to top officials in the White House and the State Department. I know that the president cares about this deeply. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, care about this agenda deeply. The challenge is now for the president to match his promise with his programs. Is he going to cut the nuclear weapons budget? Is he going to follow through on the negotiations? Is he going to push the allies to get those obsolete nuclear weapons out of Europe? The last line of the White House guidance is probably the most important thing that was said today. The president has directed all his agencies to start implementing these policies over the next year. So the struggle to implement the president's policy has just begun today.
So when you said earlier, Joseph Cerincione, that the president is not entirely dependent upon the Russian reciprocity in this, what can he do given the churlish attitude on the part of Putin and Rogozin?
Well, the Russian force is already coming down. They have several hundred fewer strategic nuclear weapons deployed right now than we do. And the reason is that their forces are aging, they're getting obsolete, and they're retiring them faster than they can replace them. It looks like they'll go down to about 1,000 by the end of this decade. So we can simply follow them down. I mean, we can take our warheads off alert. The president promised he would do that. We can take them, put them into storage. We can follow them down, knowing that the Russians can't catch up. There's also internal Pentagon studies that say this isn't any conceivable scenario where the Russians can gain an advantage on us. You know, it's not a matter of we have to match them warhead for warhead. You know, 10 warheads is enough to deter a foe from attacking us. You don't need thousands. So those are the kinds of cards that the president has, getting away from this Cold War thinking about, you know, mutually assured destruction and recognizing that a few hundred nuclear weapons are more than you need. We don't need to maintain an arsenal of thousands. And in the process, we can save money shifting it for the real threats of the 21st century.
But do the Russians feel a greater need for their arsenal than the U.S., given the fact that their conventional forces have dissipated considerably since the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union?
They do, and they place a greater role in the so-called tactical nuclear weapons, the weapons they would use in a European battle. But, you know, to be real, there isn't going to be a European battle. There's not going to be a European war. So you have to be patient with the Russians, work with them on this. And still, even with that concern, you can still get them down to a few hundred nuclear weapons, down from the 8,000 or so that they have. You can involve the other nuclear-armed countries, and the president talked about this, such as China, India, and Pakistan in these kinds of discussions. There's a clear path forward, and you just got to notch it forward. And history is on our side. The arsenals that we had at the Cold War, when Reagan made his speech, we had about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We're now down to 17,000. The arsenals have been cut by almost 80%, and they're clearly going to go lower. The curve is bending away from nuclear weapons, away from integrating these weapons as key parts of national security strategies. That's the arc that the president is pushing. That's the wave that he's riding.
And is he being pushed in any way by, for example, there's a movement in the Netherlands to get nuclear weapons off Dutch soil?
Yeah, so in that, we have about 200 hydrogen bombs still stationed in Europe, these B-61 bombs. We have a program to modernize these bombs. It's going to cost us $10 billion to modernize these weapons. And for what? Well, the Dutch and the Germans are two of the bases where these are based. They say they want them out. The Turks are a little more ambivalent about it. The Italians, they don't care one way or the other. And it's really the Eastern European countries, Poland, the Baltic states, that see these as a political symbol of U.S. commitment. Well, there are cheaper ways to demonstrate our political support for these countries and our unity with them. You don't have to spend $10 billion on obsolete bombs to do that. The president has to be a little more imaginative on how he does it. And you saw him talk about that today. He wants to work the issue. The test will be whether he does, whether he stays with it. Does he put the time and political capital into saving the United States some money and modernizing our national security strategy?
So I'm trying to get a handle here, Joe Cerciani, on where the lobbying is coming from for nuclear weapons. If we're going to spend $10 billion upgrading obsolete hydrogen bombs that the Germans and the Dutch want off their soil, and you were just telling us a minute ago that the Joint Chiefs and the top brass in the Navy, for example, don't want to buy any more nuclear submarines with nuclear missiles, the so-called boomers, because there's already enough, and this money could go to what they consider to be better use in conventional weaponry. So you've got clearly some push coming from that direction. So what is the push? Who is this pro-nuclear lobby that want to keep throwing good money after bad?
Well, it's the same kind of lobby that you get whenever you want to cut a government program. It's the people who are making money off the contracts, the people who have jobs related to the program, the people who have billets, officer positions related with it. So you see some of the senators, for example, from states that have ICBM bases, like Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, resisting cutting nuclear weapons. They don't want to lose the bases. So the trick there is to find other purposes for those bases. You see some of the contractors who make money at our nuclear labs, like Los Alamos or Livermore, saying, well, no, this is a necessary program. We have to spend $10 billion. This is essential national security. What happens is that those demands are now meeting the budget reality. You don't have enough money. The defense budget is coming down, so those are being pitted against other more vital defense needs. And politically, you see the defense hawks that used to dominate the Republican Party having resistance within their own party from the deficit hawks, the people who want to cut the budget. So you can understand where the call for more nuclear weapons or staying with the nuclear weapons program is coming from. These people who are still clinging to these obsolete weapons for financial or career reasons. That's just a decreasing voice. They are losing influence, and they know it.
So is it a combination then of the budget realities? But what about the external reality that it doesn't make any sense? I mean, they're on pretty shaky ground, and I'm just wondering what can be done for reality to catch up to this atavism.
Well, you should add into that political opponents. So, you know, the president's political opponents take every issue and try to use it as an attack on the president, show that he's weak or naive or jeopardizing national security, you know. And so you hear some of that being reflected in some of the comments in Congress today. On the other side, you have some of the leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, for example, saying that we have many more nuclear weapons than we need and we can certainly cut the budget. Adam Smith, the Democratic leader of the House Armed Services Committee, just issued a statement today applauding the president's. So you see some of the more common sense defense-minded congressman, understanding the need to rationalize. And overall, I think the combination of the decreasing threat and the budget realities are going to be the overriding factor in shrinking the nuclear arsenal. It's a fight, though. Nothing is given. We can see where the trends are going. But if the American people don't want their Congress spending their money on these weapons, they have to let them know. This is a democracy, and the voice of the people matters.
Well, just in closing, Joseph Cerisani, my understanding is the biggest and best bang for the buck the American people ever got was the Nunn-Lugar program that spent U.S. tax dollars inside Russia itself as the Soviet Union fell apart to secure these weapons and to secure the nuclear material so it didn't end up in the hands of rogues and terrorists, etc. And that is the most likely scenario of the use of nuclear weapon, outside of the fact that Pakistan has the fastest growing arsenal and maybe India and Pakistan may stumble into a nuclear war. But short of that, which is not entirely likely, there's still a great possibility of nuclear weapons ending up in the hands of so-called terrorists. So where does that stand now? Because I understand that the Republicans pretty much killed that program. I mean, again, you feel like somebody's got to be an advocate for reality out there.
Well, you're exactly right, Ian, about the importance of that. And fortunately, it has a solid bipartisan support. So even though in the early days there was some Republican opposition, by now it's solidified in Congress. The two pieces of good news, one is just last week, just earlier this week, the Russians re-upped the program. The program had lapsed. There were some concerns about liability issues, about who was to blame if something went wrong. Well, those have all been negotiated out, and the U.S. and Russians announced at the Obama-Putin summit that they were going to extend the program and continue it. So that's good news number one. Good news number two is the president announced today that he's continuing his so-called nuclear security summits. Every 2 years, he's gathered 50 nations together to pool resources to secure and eliminate all the weapons usable material in the world. It's a tough job, but we're making steady progress. He just announced that he's going to continue the process through 2016 and convene them once again in Washington. So we'll have a nuclear security summit next year in the Netherlands and then in 2016 back in Washington. So these are all good signs for securing loose nukes and preventing terrorists from getting the one weapon that could destroy an American city.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Joseph Cerisani.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cerisani, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Governmental Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about protests all across Brazil.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC, Radio Portuguese Language Service, and Radio France International. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paulo Sotero.
It's a pleasure to be back.
And Brazil is being shaken by these demonstrations and protests that are not just in the biggest city, Sao Paulo, where you are from and where you worked, but Rio de Janeiro, Salvador, Curitiba, Belém, Brasilia, the capital, So people are likening it to what's happening in Turkey and what has happened previously in Egypt and Tunisia. Are we seeing a Brazilian spring?
Well, the Brazilian spring already happened more than 25 years ago. Brazil has been a democracy. What people are doing is they're exercising their right, their civil rights in a democracy to present their grievances. This started because of overreaction by police forces in São Paulo against protests of bus fare increases. The police got this wrong and attacked the protesters, and the population that is frustrated for many reasons decided that this was the time to assert their position and say, no, we have the right to protest in this country. We want that right. So that's where, you know, there's no relationship with what is going on in other parts of the world, in the sense that we are not fighting for establishing a democracy or against an authoritarian regime. We are living a democracy. It's a very bumpy moment, but is, in my view, a moment of promise where we can get better if we take the correct lessons, if leaders take the correct messages from this and act upon people's demands.
So if it's not an analogy in terms of what's happened in the Middle East, which it clearly doesn't work, but there is, though, an economic fairness issue at the heart of this, isn't there? That Brazil is a very polarized country between a very wealthy elite and an extremely impoverished bottom end of the economic scale. And so
you are correct up to a point. Brazil is a very polarized society, but it's less polarized today than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. There was, in this time, especially in the last 10 years, the rise of middle class in Brazil, of almost 40 to 45 million people that used to be part of the poor people that are now part of lower middle class. The protest comes because the economy has stalled, the government has proved to be ineffective in some ways, and people, this young generation that has seen this promise of living in a relatively prosperous society with more equity, see now that this may not happen, and they, having tasted, this promise of having a better life, are now demanding it. They like what they seen, what they tasted. Now the problem is that the governments and the authorities have not, and the political class has not been able lately to deliver on those promises, and it's no surprise, therefore, that the protests start around a quality of life issue, which is public transportation in major cities in Brazil.
So when you see banners in these demonstrations with slogans like, "The people have awakened," what are they saying then?
Well, because until now, the people had relied on political parties, especially on the Workers' Party, a party that came from the people, has governed Brazil now for 10 years, has elected the most popular president in Brazilian history, President Lula, and all of a sudden, I think people have started to think that this connection is not working because the government has been particularly ineffective in enforcing policy, in creating policy, in ensuring that Brazil will continue to grow, that income is better distributed, with education issues are addressed, that infrastructure in Brazil is improved, and people very simply are communicated in Brazil every day that we have now moved up and we are the sixth largest economy in the world, or the seventh, depending on exchange rate used. But the fact, and then they go to their daily lives, they say, well, if we are that good, how come I have to spend 3 to 4 hours to go to work and 3 to 4 hours every day to come back from work in congested streets, in deficient public transportation. How come that we have so much crime in this country and that we see politicians that are really busy with their own lives and acting on their own self-interest and not on behalf of the people who elected them? So, and this is, you know, that we have seen signs of this coming over time. It exploded all of a sudden. Politicians in Brazil are completely perplexed. They are at a loss. They don't know what to make of this. And actually, even political analysts in Brazil that normally have, you know, very interesting opinions about everything are also quite strangely quiet.
Now, you mentioned politicians and even political pundits have been caught by surprise in Brazil. I take it that that would also apply to President Dilma Rousseff, who is a former guerrilla leader. She was imprisoned under the military dictatorship. And, of course, the police crackdown against people striking over a rise in bus fares that fanned the flames of these demonstrations. She's now trying to embrace the causes of the people. But is she behind the curve here, do you think, Paulo?
No, I not necessarily. You know, the issues that are the center and front are local issues. Okay, so people are not blaming President Rousseff. The protests are not against her. She has, I think, consulting with President Lula and others, she has reacted reasonably quickly. And yesterday, she said that Brazil has, you know, is stronger because of those protests, and trying to associate herself with the concerns, with the causes of the protesters. Now, although this is an important thing, and I think it's the right thing to do, there is also another side of this. Some of the protests yesterday evening in Rio and São Paulo have turned violent, and there were looting, there were acts of vandalism, and the media in Brazil from yesterday to today has begun to turn negative on the protests, and that could also have, you know, to appear to be too accommodating and not face acts of violence in major cities in Brazil could cost you a lot of support. So it's a difficult position. Not only the president, every Brazilian politician today are having a difficult to understand what's going on, to position themselves on this. And as far as Dilma Rousseff, I think that she has done reasonably well so far.
So it seems that a lot of the demonstrations have been focused on and have converged on the building sites for next year's World Cup soccer tournament in Brazil, which is being hosted by a country that we've always thought was soccer crazy and does incredibly well in soccer. The Brazilian team usually wins the World Cup. And the notion that so many of these protesters are against these stadiums that are being built, some of which in very small towns, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these stadiums. And that seems to be a refrain throughout a lot of these demonstrations, is why are you wasting money on building soccer stadiums and not taking care of health and education and investing in infrastructure? And as you just said, the average worker in the Brazilian city spends, 4 or 5 hours a day in gridlock just getting to and from work.
Yes. Don't get me wrong. People are using this, the soccer stadium, because, you know, we are having the pre-World Cup tournament. It's happening right now in Brazil. People are, as we speak, they are in stadiums cheering for this team and for the Brazilian national team. It's very, present. There are horrible cost increases and overruns on all those projects. People are asking questions on why, for instance, we need to build a stadium in Manaus, which is being built for the 2014 World Cup, when the the teams, the clubs from that city in the Amazon barely attract 6,000 spectators in their own regular games. So there is the white elephant syndrome here. There is also, you know, the fact that a lot of this is public money. Initially, it was promised that, you know, the private sector would come along, etc. Didn't happen. Now, obviously, I hope that every good thing you said about Brazilian soccer and the national team is true, people, you know, but you know, this business about the protest against the building of stadiums can be taken a little bit too far. I think the majority of Brazilians are happy that the championship is going to take place in Brazil. It is a matter of a discussion that we have to have about priorities. You know, we could do the exact same thing and host those games and welcome a lot of people, but we could do this with less, you know, spending money more wisely. And it's a matter of execution of programs. It has been a problem in Brazil. Governments, both at the federal level, at the state levels, they announce very ambitious and nice programs. They look very nice on paper, but then there is a problem in implementation. You have the cost overruns, and then the, you know, people look at this and say, yes, we are going to have this party. It's very nice, but how about the long-term issues that really will determine where how my life will evolve, how my kids, my children's lives will evolve. Those have to do with education, those have to do with health care, having to do with actually daily life, life quality issues associated with mass transit, with safety, etc. And this is, those protests, I think they have become, you know, expressions of all of that, this profound anxiety and unhappiness, and politicians are completely perplexed and surprised.
Well, you mentioned that even some of the pundits and scholars have been caught by surprise. The New York Times quotes Fabio Malini, a scholar who analyzes data patterns and social media at the Federal University of Espirito Santo, and he's talking about how the largest protests are happening in cities which will be hosting the World Cup Games, and says, Brazilians are mixing soccer and politics in a way that is new, and minority voices are making themselves heard. So would you agree that that is new?
Yeah, well, the protests are happening in the cities that are going to host the World Cup, because those are the largest cities, you know. Mm-hmm. We have to have the World Cup there. That's where the public is. Now, I think the professor there has a point. It's very interesting that it's happening. The image of Brazil is that we are a very happy bunch, that we are always dancing carnival, and then we want to go to soccer fields, and this is all true. But at the same time, this is a very intelligent people that are seeing, you know, that there is an imbalance here between amounts of public money spending in this, on those issues, and on stadiums, that we could do the exact same stadiums, more probably in a different way. FIFA asked Brazil to do 8 stadiums, you know, to refurbish or build 8 stadiums, and we decided to do 12. Why? We could have done 8. We could probably have done things in a more organized fashion and saved lots and lots of money that could be better or could be invested in all those other areas. You know, we took care of the stadiums, for instance. The stadiums are all there and they will be there, but the public infrastructure, especially related to mass transit, is kind of behind. And, you know, this is the frustration, but I tend to think that this, if the protests remain peaceful, if the protests remain engaged or calling the nation's attention to the issues that affect people's daily lives, I think this is an opportunity for growth. This is an opportunity for progress. This is a way a wake-up call to Brazilian political leaders, to the Brazilian political class. Now, Brazil, I insist, is a democracy. It, depending on how we respond to this, Brazilian democratic institutions will be strengthened, or if there is no response, Brazilian democratic institutions will be weakened. This is up to us. It's up to duly elected leaders of the Brazilian people.
Well, just in closing, Paulo Sotero, the other part of Mr. Malini's quote in the New York Times is that minority voices are making themselves heard. And my understanding from talking to people in Brazil is that there is tremendous, we talked about polarization, but there's also sort of ghettoization, if you will. You have the poor favelas that are teeming with people riddled with drugs and lots of violence. And then right next door to them, you have these gated wealthy communities with armed guards, etc. And that is in many ways the face of the disparity in Brazil. It's sort of right up against each other. And so when he says that the minority voices are making themselves heard, are these the voices of the favelas?
I would say, as to the extent the favelas now are inhabited by members of this lower middle class, it is. Don't believe that the protests are fueled by poor people in Brazil. This is a middle class event. It is true that what he describes, and I think he is correct, minority voices, people, especially because this is the younger people, the people that have seen the opportunity to join this better world and that fear now that they may not get there. And they're dying the streets basically saying, no, this is our country, these are our streets, and let's keep moving. Let's keep doing this. A lot of the problems that you have in, for instance, in urban spaces in Brazil, they are not the product of only of history. You know that Brazil had more slaves in its history than in most countries in the world, about 4 million compared to 900,000 in the United States, for instance. But that Brazil, over time, and even with the best of intentions, adopted public policies that exacerbated this segregation. Okay, what you described as favelas and high-rising buildings side by side, this is a direct product of bad public policies. Those images and living in those spaces, you know, makes the problem very visible, very present to Brazilian society, and is a constant invitation for society to address the issue and to resolve and to overcome this. There are new policies being conceived, being implemented, and I believe that if those protests, this is expression of a democracy working, if those protests highlight this and move a dysfunctional political class to action, I think the politicians, the leaders that do that will be compensated by the people, and Brazil will become a better country. Now, we are in the middle of this. It could go one way or the other. If you read Brazilian history, if you follow Brazil in the last 30 years since democratization and after 20 years with economic stability, you would adopt probably the more hopeful view that Brazil will be better because of what's going on in the streets there. And that is my hope and that is my belief.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Paulo Sotero.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Paulo Sotero, who's the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, which is a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and he's been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the domestic use of drones by the FBI. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ryan Callow, who is a professor of law at the University of Washington, whose research focuses on the intersection of law and emerging technology, with an emphasis on robotics and the Internet. His work on drones, driverless cars, privacy, and other topics has appeared in law reviews and major news outlets, including the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and NPR. He's a former research director at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University and has also testified before the full Senate Judiciary Committee on domestic use of drones. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Callow.
Thanks for having me.
And today, FBI Director Robert Mueller testified before the same committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, on the issue of drones. He was asked about whether they're being used domestically and said that they're, in answer to a question from Senator Grassley, he said that they're being used in a very limited way. Is that reassuring?
Well, it's unsurprising. Given the technical capabilities of drones and the low costs associated with operating them relative to manned aircraft, it is hardly surprising that the FBI would be using them domestically in some instances. The way that the FBI appears to be using drones for now is actually, I think, very positive. It's the idea of giving agents on the ground better situational awareness in a dangerous situation. The concern is whether they would start to use it in a more dragnet way. And in fact, there's really very little in privacy law that would prevent them from doing that.
So from what we know of the use of drones by the FBI, they used a drone in February, did they not, in a standoff with an Alabama man who had shot dead a school bus driver and then taken a five-year-old boy hostage?
That's my understanding as well. Again, this is a situation where having some eyes in the sky, so to speak, gives your agents better situational awareness. They understand better what's happening, and they can execute their strategy more efficiently, lowering risk to others and making sure that they cover their bases. And that's a positive use of the technology, I'd say. I think the concern that many have, including some members of the Judiciary Committee, apparently, is that this will be used for more routine surveillance, just to sort of keep an eye on folks or to patrol a particular area or to look for particular transgressions, as opposed to in unique identifiable situations like the way that the FBI has used it so far.
So the main user that we know of is Homeland Security, right? They've been using drones on the border. But this is new, the testimony today from FBI Director Mueller, in terms of the FBI using it. I'll be saying it's a small footprint. What kind of footprint do we know that the Department of Homeland Security has?
Well, so, okay, the Department of Homeland Security has a fleet of military-grade drones. They're not armed, but they are essentially the same as the Predator B that you see in the theater of war. And they use that to patrol both borders of the United States. They also occasionally will lend out a drone to domestic law enforcement. And there have been instances where, say, a sheriff or law enforcement would say, you know, look, we really could use one of your border drones to check out a particular situation, and that's occurred. So their footprint is much greater than that of the FBI. And, in fact, the Department of Homeland Security has been, in ways, encouraging domestic law enforcement to explore drone technology to see whether it can be helpful to them in their mission of protecting folks and solving crimes. And so they've really been more of a facilitator of drone use as an organization than the FBI specifically.
So in the same hearing today where FBI Director Mueller said that there have been a use of domestic use of drones by the FBI, although he says that the footprint is very small, the chairwoman of the panel, Senator Dianne Feinstein, told the FBI director that she believes that unmanned planes, drones, are the biggest threat to Americans' privacy, especially their use by private firms. And, of course, we have learned from this NSA scandal involving the contractor Edward Snowden of the extraordinary growth of private contractors in intelligence, taking up something like 70% of the entire intelligence budget. So what do you make of Senator Feinstein's warnings?
Well, okay, so a couple different things. I mean, the senator is correct when she says that there is very little in the way of privacy law that stands in the way of domestic private parties like the press, including the paparazzi, but also private individuals, you know, using drones for a variety of purposes, right? Not much on privacy law is going to prevent that. However, the Federal Aviation Administration, which controls the, you know, the nation's airways, so far has not allowed private individuals to operate drones for commercial purposes and won't do so until September of 2015, at which time they're thinking about relaxing the current ban on private commercial use of domestic drones. At that time, I believe there will be a great proliferation of drones in the United States, some of which will be used in ways that are concerning to privacy. Others will be used in totally innocuous ways, for instance, agriculture. Or, you know, in the interim, I think we're going to see much more use of drones by the government, which we're already seeing today. And that, you know, and at least in my own opinion, and I mean, I think that everyone is entitled to their views, but in my view, that is more concerning in the short term, that we'd be using them for law enforcement purposes, where the purposes are not just to get a better sense of what's going on in a particular hostage situation or to find a lost kid, but rather to engage in the kind of massive surveillance that folks are worried about the intelligence community engaging in today. And so, you know, who knows? How do you compare the threat to privacy from commercial use down the line to the current threat to privacy? It's a very difficult comparison to make. In many ways, it's apples and oranges. But the truth of the matter is that strengthening privacy law, both in the private and public sector, would be helpful in both respects.
But, Ryan Keller, couldn't you make the argument that it's not apples or orange, it's apples and oranges? And doesn't this also apply to the current story about the NSA leaks from the private contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, the idea that you both have the government snooping on American citizens and the big internet monopolies like Google and Facebook building tremendous databases on individuals? You know, Google gives you free Gmail, but the price you pay for that is that if you send out an email saying you like strawberry jam, suddenly manufacturers of strawberry jam are flooding your inbox.
So let me say this. So it is certainly the case that private collection of data by companies reinforces the opportunities for government surveillance. Okay? And that happens in a lot of different ways. I mean, first of all, the thing that people are really worried about right now, and what is underlying a lot of the concerns around NSA surveillance is a so-called third-party doctrine of the in the Fourth Amendment. And all that says basically is that when you commit something to a third party, like an internet company, for instance, then you essentially give up certain rights to it, or that's the argument, the position that the government takes, is that you give up a certain expectation of privacy with respect to that. So as we begin to store all of our stuff in the cloud and to email each other instead of talking in person, and of course for a long time now using the phone, we end up committing certain information to private entities, and that makes it easier for the government to get it, right? Now, that's a different situation in my view than the military-industrial relationship around surveillance. When a company acts on behalf of the United States, when we privatize surveillance, well, the Constitution is going to treat them, and most laws are going to treat them, as though they were the government. And so if we had private contracting drones flying around on behalf of the FBI, well, that would just be treated like the FBI. So I definitely agree that there's a very complicated relationship between industry and the internet industry and the government, and that in some ways it does make surveillance easier. But of course it's fraught with tension. I mean, you see how Microsoft and Google very vocally recently and others are pushing back against surveillance. They're trying to get the right to talk about the deals that they have with the government. They're trying to talk about the requests they're getting for information. They're trying to push back in the courts against consumer data leaving their hands because, you know, their lifeblood is consumer trust. And so it really is a complicated relationship. I wouldn't say that it's all in any one direction.
And again, I speak with Ryan Keller, who is professor of law at the University of Washington, whose research focuses on the intersection of law and emerging technology. He's formerly research director at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University. He's testified before the full Senate Judiciary Committee on the domestic use of drones. Tell me about your recent testimony.
Well, the senators wanted to understand what legal restraints, if any, were already associated with the domestic use of drones. And my role there, as I understood it, was to talk about privacy law and where privacy law stands in the way of domestic use of drones and where it doesn't. And the gist of my remarks was that in most instances, privacy law doesn't have a lot to say about using drones here. And that has to do with the fact that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in public, generally speaking, and that's where, or even anything visible from a public vantage. In other words, if the FBI were to fly over your backyard, that you probably would not be able to bring any kind of constitutional challenge for what they saw in your backyard, even though it's your own property. That may be changing. After this case in the Supreme Court, United States v. Jones, where a majority of justices expressed concern over following folks around using GPS devices for long periods of time, you could imagine a case where drones followed someone around for a long time. You could see courts following Jones to an extent there, but it's not obvious because Jones involved physically attaching a GPS device to a car, whereas drones don't have to attach to anything. They can just follow you in the air. And so I saw my role in that particular testimony as just explaining legal context. I talked about the Fourth Amendment. I also talked about common law privacy torts, such as intrusion upon seclusion. And tort is where, you know, you sue another person for harm that doesn't come out of contract, mostly. And so I was explaining to them the sort of history of the privacy torts in the United States, and the senators were, I thought, very engaged and well-informed, and it was a productive discussion. Also there were, of course, representatives from law enforcement, from the unmanned aerial systems community, and also from the civil liberties side, from EPIC, which is a privacy organization in D.C.
So how much is the Fourth Amendment intruded on, though? If you've got a drone overhead, the idea that the Fourth Amendment says that the citizen should be secure in their person and their papers, obviously it's a different era that it was written in, but still, if you're at home, your person and your papers, aren't they? I mean, they can certainly look at you in your backyard, but they can also look at you through infrared inside your home. So it's an intrusion. So how does the 18th century intention deal with the 21st century reality?
Well, I mean, that is a very good question that a lot of us have been thinking about for some time. And so just on your point about looking into someone's house using, say, thermal imaging, we'll say the Supreme Court did actually look at that particular issue in Kylo, and this Justice Scalia, writing for the majority of the Supreme Court, said you would, in fact, have a search in a situation where you're using a technology that's not generally available in public, to the public rather, and you're looking into the interior of the house. And so on those specific facts, you might not, closer question whether you happen to look into someone's window and see something. I mean, there was a case where this is manned flight, but I don't see why it wouldn't apply to drones as well, where officers, flew over a greenhouse, and there happened to be like a panel or two missing from a greenhouse, and looking through the greenhouse, they were able to spot marijuana plants. And so anything that's visible from a public advantage is by and large a fair game with a couple of possible exceptions. One other thing I worry about a lot is, there's this idea within Fourth Amendment law today that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something that's illegal, in contraband. And that's why, dogs can sniff your bag at the airport, because the idea is they only signal to the officer where you have something that you shouldn't have, and you have no expectation of privacy in contraband, something unlawful. Recently, the Supreme Court decided a case involving the dog sniffing of the home as opposed to using the, thermal imaging. And what the Supreme Court said was, bringing a dog onto the property for purposes of sniffing it, that is an intrusion and therefore triggers the Fourth Amendment. But it's not as though we couldn't put chemical sensors on drones. And so imagine imagine drones that just flew around looking for particular kinds of activities. If they only alerted when there was unlawfulness that they saw, maybe they only alerted when they saw somebody with a gun who they don't think is licensed, or they only alerted when they came across an illegal compound or chemical like like marijuana, that feels like a pretty severe threat to civil liberties that may not register all that well on the Fourth Amendment. And so, as you say, the Fourth Amendment, it's certainly true that technology and surveillance technology has far outpaced the changes in privacy law, and that we are at a situation where we need to correct against that disconnect.
Well, just in closing, Ryan Callow, we remember recently Senator Rand Paul conducting a filibuster where he was trying to extract a promise from President Obama that the use of drones in chasing terrorists abroad would not be used domestically and there would be no such thing as a drone strike against a U.S. citizen on American soil. And he got that note from Eric Holder saying that we wouldn't do it. And it felt a bit more like a stunt more than anything else. But was there any substance to that? Is there any, in other words, Eric Holder's assurance, how binding is that?
Well, so first of all, I have some fond memories of that filibuster because a senator read aloud from one of my essays. And so I paid more attention than I might have to the substance there. As to your question about Holder's letter, I'm not an expert in how the executive can bind itself, but what I understand the letter to be was an interpretation on the part of the Attorney General of what the Attorney General believed to be the executive powers in this instance. I think that there was a little bit of theater there, both on the part of the senator and on the part of the Attorney General. I think that if we ever were to use drones domestically to actually harm someone or kill them, that would run afoul of a lot of different kinds of laws, and we would see an enormous discussion erupt around that. I feel personally very assured that that will not happen. I don't believe that the United States government will ever use a drone. A military-style drone that's armed on American citizens on American soil. I just couldn't possibly see that happening, irrespective of the letter that went back and forth. I watched that with great interest, and it certainly did nothing for the image of drones, which we've tend to tie to the theater of war already, which is part of the reason that we're so skeptical about them.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ryan Callow.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ryan Callow, who's a professor of law at the University of Washington, whose research focuses on the intersection of law and emerging technology with an emphasis on robotics and the Internet. His work on drones, driverless cars, privacy, and other topics has appeared in law reviews and major news outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and NPR. He's a former research director at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University, and he's also testified before the full Senate Judiciary Committee on the domestic use of drones. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.